You've been working as a Vatican correspondent since 1982 or 83, right?
Well, I took my first trip with Pope John Paul II in 1982. I started covering the Vatican before that a little bit for United Press International, but at the time there was another person who was also doing it. I took my first international trip in 1982 with Pope John Paul II. It was a trip to Western Africa. If I remember correctly, it was Benin, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, and another country. Yeah, I can't remember the other country. Four countries, in any case. The trip we just finished now to Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia was my 126th trip with popes, three popes.
So how many trips have you taken altogether?
126.
100, oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, you were just in the Baltic states, in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. What were your highlights from this trip?
Well, I think that I was with John Paul II in 1993, 25 years ago. We did the same trip, the same countries, the same three countries, except the historic moment was completely different. As you know, it was two years after independence, and it was just a few years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, etc., and the first democratically elected government in Poland. So the atmosphere, particularly in Lithuania, but in all three of the countries, was much more heady. It was kind of like, you know, we're finally free. We can, you know, we're testing out democracy for the first time. He was very encouraging to them. The atmosphere was completely different. And it was just like, I don't know, somebody just had a baby, it was full of expectations. So this last trip was different. This last trip was different in the sense that, you know, it's a quarter of a century since in more than 27 years since independence. So now the people are more mature, but they've also have other different kind of problems with some fear of the big neighbor next door. But also I think that society has changed a lot. Obviously I was not surprised, but I did notice the shopping centers, et cetera. So, I mean, basically the three countries are like many other Western countries, problems of materialism, I guess, consumerism, and things like that. It's very similar to the other countries that I've gone to in the former Soviet bloc, either the Warsaw Pact, the Eastern Europe countries, Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, places like that, or even countries such as the three Baltics that were full part of the USSR. There's a similar kind of historical a similar kind of historical progression, where you reach a point and you would say which side do we want to go to? We want to go towards Europe, or we want to go towards Russia. And most have chosen to go towards Europe, including Poland and the three Baltics. So I think he was very sort of spot on in talking about some of the issues, some of the problems that the three countries are facing. Particularly when on the last day in Estonia, that he spoke so clearly about, you know, making noise with threats of missiles and things like that, that he just, you know, hit the nail on the head as far as the political situation is concerned. I think he was also, it reminded me of when John Paul used to go back to Poland, and he would say, you know, you've worked really hard for this freedom, but then, you know, you just don't want to sort of, real freedom is not just that you can buy anything you want. There's real freedom is not just, you know, fancy cars and shopping centers and, you know, Western style shopping centers and movie theaters. It's much more than that. And it's deeper than that. So I think that there was a bit of that message in the trip as well.
Now in Latvia, some people have taken issue that it seemed that, well, especially in Riga, there were not so many people coming to meet Pope. It might have to do with also the weather. But did you notice that perhaps there was a 25 years ago of John Paul II, taking into consideration the, you know, the historic events which had happened just a couple of years ago, and now 25 years after that, there are not so many people coming to see the Pope in the Baltic States.
I think that the crowds are very easy to explain. The crowds, I don't think it was so much the weather. It was maybe a combination of a couple of things: weather, the fact that today you can see anything on TV. And because of since 9/11, any place he goes, the security is just—it can be maddening. 25 years ago, I mean, you know, you would just, you know, walk into a stadium, and maybe you had to go through a metal detector. But not even then. I mean, the security was nothing of what it is today. So old people, particularly older people, just don't have that kind of strength anymore. You know, to stand for 2 hours in a line to go through security for an event that then lasts an hour and a half or even less. You just see it on TV. It's more comfortable. You actually see more on TV. But I repeat, this has happened in a lot of places. The atmosphere at the time, also because, as you know, the only Catholic country of the three is Lithuania. But before, there were big crowds, and 25 years ago, there were big crowds in all three countries, even in the least religious, Estonia, because he was seen not just as a religious, John Paul was not seen as just as a religious person, but someone who in an indirect way had something to do with their freedom, because he had supported the Solidarność Union in Poland. Solidarność led to the first democratically elected government. Then there was Hay and Gorbachev and Reagan at the same time. So he was one of the players in history. And so I would compare it to, I don't know, you know, people want to see a person because he's a great historical figure, not necessarily because you're Catholic and he's the Pope. I would compare it to, I don't know, people running out on the street, and, you know, when Charles Lindbergh came back to New York after making the first solo flight. I mean, you would want to see him to be able to tell your kids, I saw, you know, Charles Lindbergh, or, you know, I saw the first person who landed on the moon in a parade. I actually saw him with my eyes, didn't, you know, watch on TV. And you were living history 25 years ago, and that's why I think that a lot of people wanted to be part of history, of seeing this man in the flesh. So historic situation has changed now. Communications has changed now. You can watch the whole thing on your iPhone. You can watch it on TV. And I think that that has to do a lot with the number of people that turn out at these events, including security, because it happens here in Italy as well. There are fewer people everywhere because security has to be so tight that, you know, people don't have the patience for it, particularly elderly people.
Now, you've been working with 35 plus years. You've been traveling with three popes, three different popes: John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and now Pope Francis. As a Vatican correspondent, is it different to work with? Has it been different to work with each of them? They have different personalities as well.
Yes, definitely. It's not that, you know, it's not that we have a personal relationship with any of these three popes, but their characters are completely different. And I think that it's kind of, again, as I was saying, it's just living through history. So John Paul's papacy coincided with a lot of political changes between Eastern and Western Europe. Benedict's was a little bit different period of history, different personality, and Francis is, again, a different one. As far as the three personalities are concerned, John Paul was a very, very personable guy, but he was a very shrewd politician. He knew... He knew how to influence events. He was spontaneous, but spontaneous almost in a calculated way. He was a showman, in a sense. I'm not saying it in a negative sense of the word, but in a positive sense of the word. He was the first to really understand the power of communications, the power of the first pope to understand the power of communications, the power of the gesture, the power of television. He understood the power of gestures, doing certain things on certain trips.
And Pope Francis?
Yes, Pope Francis as well. No, Pope Francis is very personable, and he also understands powers of gestures. But he's much, much more of an improviser. He improvises quite a few of the things that he does when he's on trips. Very fairly, for example, John Paul occasionally would not read one of his prepared speeches. He would occasionally say, you know, somebody wrote this for me. I don't really think it expresses exactly what I want to say to you today. And so I'm just going to, you know, do it myself. Francis does that more often. Benedict hardly ever strayed from what had been prepared for him. Very, very rarely. If he did, it was just to change, excuse me, one or two words. But he was a much more structured person. They were all very, very friendly. I would suppose that I'm probably closest to Francis simply because I've been covering him with a bit closer. I interviewed him 2 months ago in June. I was the first American journalist to get an interview with him, and we sat down together alone with no one else in the room for 2 hours after the photographer left. And that was quite an experience. He's very, very personable. He didn't have notes. I mean, he read, we had some themes that we wanted to discuss, but there was no veto power on anything. There was no anything like that. And he went off the record several times, told me things that I said, I'm telling you this to understand, illustrate the point I'm trying to make, but it's not for your article. So he had tremendous trust. And I came out feeling that we had a long conversation rather than an interview, which it was, because he would interrupt me, I interrupted him. It wasn't sort of question. We exchanged a few jokes about people, things like that. And so I didn't feel like I was sitting next to a pope. You know, I felt that I was just, you know, sitting next to a very interesting person.
And that's something of a thing that attracts many people, it seems.
Yes, yes, yes. I think that, yes, that's true. I mean, I think that... I think that there are a lot of people who are not religious or they're not Christians who admire him quite a bit for the things that he's doing, which have nothing directly to do with religion, but in general, it is just basically express religious values, and we're talking about things like defense of the environment, helping the poor, and immigration. When I go back to Boston very often, which is where I studied in university, I go back. My daughter is there now, working there, and I go back at least twice a year. I stay with a friend who's a Jewish family that I've known for 40 years from when I was, more than 40 years when I was studying, and you know, she's Jewish and she loves this pope. That's also because she's very concerned about the environment. She's very concerned about immigration. She's very concerned about social issues, the huge and growing gap between the wealthy and the poor in places, particularly in the United States. So there's a lot of people who have nothing to do with religion. Either they're not religious at all, or they are members of another religion, or they are lapsed Catholics, but they still like him very, very much. So he has this very, very broad appeal. That said, obviously, there are on the other side, there's a minority of very, very conservative Catholics who do not like what he's doing, particularly in the area of sexual morality, in the area of concentrating more on the social aspects rather than the doctrinal aspects of the church. Because of that, they are attacking him for other things, but what every chance they get, they are attacking him. So he does have a very small but powerful, vocal, and wealthy conservative element in the church, which is backed by conservative money in the United States, that is making life very difficult for him. But for the most part, I think that his popularity is still very, very, very high.
No, he's popular, and he has messages, a lot of messages disseminates, which appeal to people. But do they really have effect globally as well on the people or on the state's policies? Say here in the Baltic states, he talked about accepting differences and different people and so on. Do you think that his messages have an effect, the messages of the Pope and of the Pope
Francis?
Well,
it depends. If one is a believer in faith, then that's you really can't do much more than that, because essentially you can't sort of, there's two parts to your answer to your question. It's a two-part answer. One is that if he's the leader of the largest church in Christianity, he's going to preach those kind of things, and then it will sink in to some people, and it will not sink in to other people. On the other hand, the Vatican is also a political force in the sense that it has diplomatic relations with more than 170 countries around the world, is a permanent observer at the United Nations, etc. And it can influence things. For example, he is very, very concerned about climate change and global warming. And so 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, in 2015, he wrote this major encyclical, Laudato Si, on the defense of the environment, and warned that most scientists believe that climate change is man-made, sea levels are going to rise, etc., unless we start doing something about it. He timed it so that it would influence the Paris conference on global warming, which it did. It was made very clear that he backed that. That Paris conference was a big success for him, because it went through, not just for him but others as well. So people do listen to the moral voice of the papacy, and as I said before, morals is not just sexual morals or other things like that. But he's saying, caring about your environment, caring about the poor, caring about other people is just as important as caring about, unborn life, things like that. And so that's what a lot of conservatives have difficulty swallowing. He is as against abortion as any of his predecessors, but he doesn't think that the church should be obsessed about having cultural wars on it, where people don't even talk to each other anymore about issues such as abortion, such as homosexuality, how the church should welcome homosexuals, etc. It hasn't changed any of the teachings of the church. The teaching on homosexual behavior, or homosexual acts, I should say, has not changed. The teaching against abortion has not changed. Teaching against women priests has not changed. But in other areas, he's more welcoming. And so basically, for example, one of the documents that came out that that conservatives are very against is a document called Amoris Laetitia, which kind of opens the door for Catholics who divorced and then remarried outside the church, because the church does not permit divorce. It permits only marriage annulment. These people who have had terrible first marriages, even, you know, women who were beaten by their first husbands, they finally find love with another person after they've left their abusive spouse. This is just an example. And if both of them are Catholic, because they were divorced, they cannot go to communion unless they live like a brother and sister, meaning having no sex. These kind of things is basically trying to find exceptions, saying, well, you know, if in their conscience they believe that, you know, that they should go to communion, they could go to communion, then they, together with a priest or a bishop, can decide these things on a one-by-one basis. He's much more open to that. He's, he's not changed any of the teachings, say, on homosexual acts. They are still considered, yeah. But he says we have to welcome homosexuals into the church. We have to be caring for them. We can't just, you know, continue saying that they are, you know, depraved or whatever, as previous popes have said.
Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that, well, you mentioned that he was also spontaneous in some way, and also of his personality, that Pope Francis' remarks and attitude has caused many to believe that he is a liberal pope, which many conservatives, conservative wing, takes an issue with, that he's a reformer. You mentioned homosexuality, issue of celibacy, women priests, and so on. But his personal attitude is still a conservative in a church sense, that he's not about to change any of that.
It's just, well, doctrinally conservative, no. What is doctrine? No, he said many times, he said the door to women priests is closed. I can't open it anymore. John Paul closed it. It's closed. Abortion is killing. Those kind of things there. But, you know, do we then completely exclude a woman who has had an abortion from a future life in the church? I mean, women don't have abortions because they're wanting to have abortions. Are very serious thing. It's do we exclude these people, or are we more merciful to them? Because if the church cannot be merciful towards sinners, then what can it be merciful towards? There's no such thing as the perfect person, and so there are a lot of elements that we are now seeing, particularly in the United States, a kind of blending of conservative politics, conservative money, and conservative religion. And they are each helping each other. So you basically have conservatives who are against climate change, or saying they don't believe in climate change, and they have nothing to do with religion, but it's convenient for them to join up with conservative Catholics who do not like Pope Francis for doctrinal reasons, because they can help each other get their way. If you see what I mean. So there's a lot of that going on right now. What's happening in the church right now, or I should say in some sections of the church right now, mm-hmm. is extremely similar to what is happening in the United States, with this incredible polarization, almost this tribal warfare between one party and the other, which is played out on Twitter, which is played out on social media, which is played out on TV. It's very, very similar now.
And for that happening within the church, what is the reason for that? Is that the Pope Francis pontificate? Is that the reason, or there are some other reasons?
It is because of the things that I just said, but it's also because we are now in the age of Twitter, where any Catholic could pontificate, no pun intended, on Twitter about trying to be a Twitter theologian. Uh, and uh, in the age of social media, I mean, you know, I get stuff sometimes when I write something and saying, how can you, you know, protect that pope who is whatever. I'm not protecting anybody, I'm just writing about it, but the media, social media has become very, very polarized now, and either you're, you know, you're a fan of Francis or you're not a fan of Francis. Now, you know, social media was just taking off, or maybe didn't even exist at the you know, when John Paul was around, it didn't exist as the way it exists now. The internet was just starting, I think. And so he is his papacy is taking place in a much different historical period as far as the media is concerned. He just started tweeting, I think, under Benedict, and obviously Benedict doesn't tweet, did not tweet himself, and neither does John Paul. I mean, he may have a thing, but I mean, you know, but he's not like Trump, where he's actually sending his own tweets. I mean, you know, he's sending something that's just a passage from the gospel, or you know, let us remember the earth today, or something like that, which obviously people are expressing his thoughts, but they're getting around to a lot of people. But now with social media, it's become much more immediate. The criticism has become much more immediate. The praise has become more immediate. It's become widespread. Even people who I could say would be not even qualified to you know, sort of judge a pope, having never you know, studied theology or anything else, all of a sudden they are, you know, doctrinal experts, and one follows the other, and it's very, very messy. It's very, very messy.
Now you mentioned the criticism, and one of the criticism the church is facing, especially recently during the Pope Francis pontificate, is the sexual abuse scandals, which Pope Francis also mentioned at least, I guess, once only in Tallinn, meeting with the youth, that he acknowledge that it kind of pushes away people from the church,
Right.
and these scandals have undermined the church, and many say that it has not done enough on the matter. And Francis, on a trip back to Rome after the Baltic States said that Rome has actually spared, you know, no effort, and it has it's really doing something about that. Now, how do you see it?
Well, I think there's we have to make the distinction between direct sexual abuse, say of a child by a priest, and covering up sexual abuse. Now, if you take a country like the United States, which was basically had a big storm of sexual abuse allegations going back many years, which erupted in Boston in 2002 with the Boston Globe Spotlight series, and many of those things, those cases took place before then, and since then, there are a lot of good regulations that are in place in the Catholic Church in the United States for trying to prevent, detect, and reporting abuse. So the number of actual cases of abuse have gone down in the States. And this is also true, for example, with the Pennsylvania grand jury report. It showed that towards the end of the 70 years that were studied, they started tapering off. The big problem, which the Pope has begun confronting in Chile. I mean, he admitted himself that, you know, they arrived late at the situation, at the solution. The big problem is that institutionally, the Church was doing what all sectors of society were doing at the time. That's not to excuse anything, because priests are supposed to look after children and not abuse them. You could say the same thing about parents. I mean, we know that statistically most sexual abuse takes place within the family, within the home, within a neighborhood. You know, people who children trust, you know, your uncle, your father, your uncle's friend next door, that kind of stuff there. I mean, most of it takes place there. But now, I mean, that doesn't excuse anything. He said even if one priest sexually abuses a child, it's a monstrosity. The issue now is accountability for bishops who did what everybody else was doing at the time, which is covering things up, sending priests from one parish to the other. Now, they should be held accountable. What he's had the difficulty of doing is setting up a structure to make them accountable. There's a lot of resistance, not only within the Vatican, but within the bishops themselves. I mean, basically, if you go back far enough, there's probably, you know, every bishop has some kind of dirt if you go back far enough, because that's what was done. It was the wrong thing. It should have been different. They should have been defrocked immediately, and they should have been given to the police. But that wasn't done. And so the next thing is to make sure that bishops are held accountable, those who mishandled abuse cases in the past and those who mishandle it now. So I think we moved on to a new phase of that. That said, you know, when these investigations come out, they're devastating, because even though most of them took part in the past, the credibility of the entire institution suffers. So, I mean, people want to be convinced that things have changed as far as the type of people who are selected to become priests, how they does every parish have in place procedures to prevent abuse? Does it deal with abuse right away? Does it tell those kind of things there? Now, so in a country like the United States, they're well advanced. In other countries, particularly in Latin America, or particularly in Africa, I would say that, you know, in the future, all kinds of things are going to be popping up about abuse in Africa and Asia, because the reporting system was and is not in place. But the most important thing is to screen people who become priests very carefully, that they do not have any of these tendencies, that they are happy with their own sexuality, or lack of it, I should say. They're happy being celibate. And it clearly, you have to choose people very, very carefully. So you have to have screening procedures for those who go into seminaries. One of the things that's been happening in the church, if you go back 50 years ago, more than 50, 60 years ago, people were becoming priests at a very young age, and they were sort of not becoming priests at a young age, but they were making decisions. They were going into the minor seminary. There were kids who were going into the minor seminary deciding at 14 that they wanted to be a priest. Now, it's very difficult for anybody to know what they want to do with the rest of their life at 14. It's still difficult at 18, and still difficult at 22. At 18 is a little bit more possible, but certainly at 22, the older you get, the more mature decision you can make. Well, minor seminaries, which kids used to go into seminary at 14 years old and do high school there, and then do college in the seminary, etc., they virtually don't exist anymore. There may be one or two in some countries, but for the most part, they don't exist anymore. One of the positive things is that a lot of men are going into the seminary as older people. In other words, people who, I know somebody who is a bishop now. He was a correspondent in he was a television correspondent, and then became a priest and is now a bishop in the United States. These people already had other life experiences. And they're making this choice at a more mature age, which is these more mature, they call them mature vocations. And the church is heading in that direction, where there are fewer. I remember when I was in the United States and we would go to visit the seminary, because they used to take us kids who were growing up in the inner city, that did not have, we were basically poor working class kids. They would, take us for a week to the seminary to, just get some fresh air and stuff like that. And, play some soccer. And the pictures of the that year's graduating class of seminarians. There were many, many. I mean, there were sort of, you know, 50 graduating. Just one seminary would be graduating like 1,500 priests a year. Now you're lucky if you get five or six. So, you know, the number of vocations has definitely gone down, but there are older vocations that are more mature and more likely to avoid getting people into the seminary who have sexual problems.
So would you say that, well, these cases that are reported now in the recent years, Pennsylvania and now in Germany as well, this month, in September, they've been piling up for, because of being swept under the carpet, they've been piling up for dozens of years, and now they're just, you know, all gone out altogether. Would you say that the cases of sexual abuse are, there's less of them now these days in the church than they were in the past?
Well, definitely there's less going on now than there was 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago, without a doubt. Because most of these cases, it's still going on, but it's much, much less. Many of the cases have to do with some time ago. Even the German report had to do with the last 70 years. The further you go back, the more that you find. Things were covered up. The church was more powerful in any country. They were able to, you know, they were able to hide things. It's easier now. It's much more difficult. You have civilian criminal authorities who are starting investigations. In the case in Germany, the report that just came out on Tuesday, I believe, the last day of the Baltics trip, that was commissioned by the church itself, and it was carried out by some universities in Germany.
Yes.
In Pennsylvania, that grand jury report was done by prosecutors, so now the church the state authorities are beginning to investigate it. The problem is that there will always be cases that are coming out that were from the past, because it's just like the today, for example, the woman who was accusing Judge Kavanaugh of molesting her, more than 30 years ago. She didn't tell anybody until just a little while ago. In many cases, people have the courage now to speak about what happened to them 20, 30, 40 years ago. So you'll be getting more people who have the courage to come out and say, look, I was abused 40 years ago. It's not so much a case of criminal case anymore, because in many cases the abusers are dead or either the statute of limitations has come in, but more people are have the courage to come out, which is good, because years ago they wouldn't have said. They would have carried this the rest of their lives, kept it quiet, perhaps affected their own lives, definitely affected their own lives. So you'll have more cases coming out, but relating to the past, and it also depends on what country that you're in, because in countries like the United States and countries like, you know, the European countries, the Northern European countries, they're much, much more it's much more likely that people will come out and talk. In Southern European mentalities or South America, where the church is still not only very powerful but still a very integral part of society, people are still afraid of coming out and saying things. And you also had cases where parents themselves didn't believe their children, you know.
Yeah.
They had such a high opinion of priests that the parents themselves didn't believe their children. If their children had the courage to say anything, they would say, you know, you shut your mouth, you can't say, you know, those things, that you can't be, those are lies, etc. You have to remember, for example, in immigrant societies, particularly, you know, the United States, South America, Italian immigrants, German immigrants, you know, the church was the whole center of their lives in the United States. The Polish immigrants in Chicago, Connecticut, the Italians in New York, the The church was the whole center of their lives. Their kids went to school to Catholic schools. Their kids went to Catholic churches. The parents were working in factories. They were working in the mines. They left. They had this enormous respect for the church. And I know that if I had told my mother when I was a kid that I had been abused, I wasn't. But if I had told her, she would have probably slapped me on the face and say, how could you tell such lies? They were just, it was kind of like, a teenage girl trying to tell her parents that, that she was raped. Maybe some parents would say, well, maybe, you shouldn't have worn that short skirt or something like that. There was all kinds of social elements that made people afraid to talk. And that's changing now on many, many levels of society.
So the church is now worried and trying to do stop it, but there's still more cases to come in the future.
There are definitely more cases to come in the future. Yeah. Just as abuse will continue in families, just as abuse will continue in sports, in sports educational places. You find these football coaches in the United States who were gods, and then they were considered gods, and then it comes out that they had sexually abused boys in the locker room. It's definitely not going to come to a complete end, just as the way it's not going to come to a complete end in families or in sports situations or in other religions. It's unfortunately something that there will always be some, but I think definitely there will be fewer and fewer, and the church has learned the hard way that you have to deal with these things quickly. Once anyone is even, credibly suspected, that's it, no mercy in that sense. You're just basically put away from, taken away from children, until the thing is cleared up, immediately. Before it was all hush hush. And I'm sure that in the past, some innocent people were accused and suffered the rest of their lives. Most of them were guilty, however, but it was covered up. Abuse will definitely continue to pop up here and there in the future, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be much less than before, because the system of covering things up or hiding it because it was so shameful hopefully won't exist anymore.
Now, some time ago, there was a piece by an atheist Italian journalist, Scalfari, about the hell issue. You probably remember that, who interviewed Pope Francis, and according to him, he said that there is no hell, but rather a disappearance of soul. And Vatican reacted to that, saying it's not a faithful transcription of the interview. Now you've heard about that, and
yes.
What's your take on this issue of this story?
My take with is that essentially the person who wrote that is an old person, is in his 90s, I think he's 93. His name is Eugenio Scalfitti. He prides himself on not taking notes, not recording anything, and reconstructing things later on. So. The Vatican said that that was not said. I think that in a conversation one could say, well, what is hell? Even that is this journalist specifically, he has now spoken to the Pope 2-3 times, and each time. He comes out and he writes these things, which are just total reconstructions, and some of them don't make any sense. And he has admitted, talking to people, saying that that's just the way I work. He's very old style. I mean, writing more novels than interviews. Mm-hmm. Doesn't take notes, doesn't record, and reconstructs everything. So I could imagine, I interviewed the Pope for 2 hours. I brought in 3 tape recorders just in case one didn't work. I had a backup, and if 2 didn't work, I would still have a backup. And, you know, I think that that was a fault of the, I think that that was something that was, you know, concocted by the journalist. If you have a kind of an intellectual conversation, you know, you say, well, what is hell? Nobody really knows because nobody's been there and back. So
it's an ongoing discussion even within the church, probably.
Definitely, because, I mean, is it really fire that it is just, I mean, is it really, I mean, a lot of stuff is artist depictions. I mean, what is hell? I mean, there are a good number of theologians that basically that hell exists, but it's not a physical place in the sense, you know, that it's here and then, you know, below, and then above that is purgatory and above that is heaven. That it's just, it's the absence of God. You know, many theologians will say that if it is, it may not be a physical place, probably not a physical place, but it's the absence of, definitely the absence of God, in the sense that we don't know what happens after we die, and we don't know anything. So if hell is the absence of God, and you then realize, yes, that there, I am not with God, but other people are, and it's such a terrible suffering, then that can be described as hell, whether it's a physical place or whether it's the way medieval artists have portrayed it, you know, as tongues of fire and, you know, the devil with a pitchfork and things like that, you know.
Do you think Pope Francis, who is 81 years old right now, will he follow the precedent or the example of Pope Benedict XVI of Ratzinger and resign when he feels that perhaps his time has come to end his papacy?
Yes, definitely. He said that as much. He said it to me. He said it before. If he feels that he doesn't have the health, that he cannot, he said that he would do it. Right now, he said, I'm feeling fine. He's not even thinking about it. He said, I'm not even thinking about it. Clearly, it would be a really very strange situation in the church to have 2 emeritus popes. So I doubt, you know, even if he is very, very sick, I cannot see that, you know, that he is going to resign while Pope Benedict is still alive. Now, Pope Benedict is, I think, 91, 92 now. Francis is 81, as you said, and he seems to be in pretty good health, despite, you know, an occasional pain in the leg because of the sciatica that he suffers from, a pinched nerve in the spinal cord. He definitely will if he feels that way. He said that as much. He said that Benedict has opened the door to that, that he has established you know, this position of Pope Emeritus. But, you know, that's a very controversial topic because there's a lot of people who think that Benedict made a very, very bad mistake in resigning. A lot of conservative things that he should never have resigned. It's a very controversial thing. It was a controversial thing when it happened. You know, there are some people who want to see if you're sick, you just stay there until you die, like John Paul did. I mean, the difference is that, you know, many, many years ago, there was very little contact between a pope and the public. There was no TV, there was no radio, there was nothing the last century, that century, 100 years ago. And so basically a pope could be sick for a long, long time. Things to be taken care of by other
people.
Nobody
would even know.
And nobody would know. And even then, I don't know how far back the custom of the Sunday blessing and the Wednesday audience goes back. I'm not, the Wednesday audience doesn't really go back, you know, I don't know how many years back it goes, but I think it really just started, I think, with Paul VI, but I'm not sure about that. But the Sunday blessing probably goes back a little bit more. But essentially, you know, very few people would have known back then that the Pope was sick. And the joke was always that the Vatican would always say the Pope would always say the Pope is in fine health. They would say the Pope is in fine health until the minute before he died. But that's the way it was, you know, centuries and decades ago. So I think that he has said that he would be ready to resign if he was really in bad health. But there's quite a few people who think that, you know, it should be a lifetime thing, even if you're really suffering. It becomes very difficult because you don't want other people making decisions for you. And I believe that towards the end of his papacy, there were other people that were making decisions for John Paul. That he was in a really bad way, with a very advanced Parkinson's, couldn't breathe, had difficulty breathing, et cetera, had difficulty talking. So that I'm sure that there were some people like his secretary and the Cardinal Secretary of State at the time, Sodano, who was making decisions for them. And that becomes dangerous. And that is, I think, what a pope would want to avoid by resigning rather than letting other people make decisions for him. And I think that one of the reasons that Benedict resigned is that he saw, when he was the cardinal in the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, he saw the final years of John Paul's life. He saw how he was essentially dying in public on TV. He went to the hospital, it was on TV. Came out of the hospital, it was on TV. He had a tracheotomy, it was on TV. I mean, he would pop up, you know, he would be at the window and you could see that he had a tracheotomy. It was a hole in his throat. Benedict did not want that kind of public death, and he definitely did not want people making decisions for him. Now, that said, he resigned in a very particular period of church history because he said that he didn't have the strength of mind and body. But there were other elements as well because of the total mess of the situation with Vatican leaks and everything. And what has become, what is quite ironic, is that if you talk to people who are close to Pope Benedict, they say that his body is that of a 91-year-old man. Gets tired, can't walk, but that his mind is still super sharp, which begs the question, if his mind is still super sharp, then why did he resign?
Why would it be a problem to have two popes emeritus?
Well, because it's been difficult enough having one, because essentially the conservatives in the church, for example, people who miss Benedict, there are many of them who don't recognize Pope Francis. As long as Benedict's still alive, he's saying, my pope is not Francis, it's Benedict. Even though he resigned and he that he's called Pope Emeritus, they still look up to him. And every time there's something happening, they try to get some signal from him with people close to him that, you know, that he doesn't agree with what Francis is doing, that he has avoided that. But people who are close to him, or people who say they are close to him, are trying to sort of put friction between the Pope Emeritus and the current pope. So if you have three, you can imagine how difficult that would be. This is an institution. It's not the presidency. It's an institution that you know, for better or for worse, has been a lifetime position for centuries. The last pope to resign was Celestine V, 600 years before Benedict. So you know, having a Pope Emeritus is very difficult. And and it would even be more difficult if you have two Pope Emeritus in different parts of the world, because then, you know, people who were believing that that person is still the valid Pope, even though he resigned, would be flocking to wherever that person is living. They can't do that because he's in the Vatican. But just imagine that Benedict had decided to go back to Germany right, and live at the top of a mountain or something like that. You know, people would be making pilgrimages to wherever he'd be living, you know, to show that, you know, this is my pope, not the one in Rome. You'd have a very sticky, messy, schismatic, potentially schismatic situation. You wouldn't have a schismatic situation because the leader would have to be, you know, in agreement, but you would have a very, very messy situation. You already do, but it'd be even messier if you had more than one Pope Emeritus. Anyway, I hope it happens after I retire because I won't be able to deal with that.
No, my last question is that now Pope Francis, for Pope Francis, this was his, the trip to the Baltic States was his 25th as Pope.
Right.
Now you've done more than 130 trips with three different popes now.
Mm-hmm.
Now how you have given perhaps any advice to Pope Francis? If
I would say stay a little
question.
Well, if he asked me, he probably won't. But I would stay a little bit longer in places. You know, you see, it's not, you can't, his trips are short, and so were Benedict's trips were also short. Francis likes to sleep in the same bed every night. I mean, basically, he likes to sort of, likes to be close to home, that kind of comfort. Benedict was the same way. John Paul was a wanderlust. I mean, he just really liked traveling, particularly when he was young. He was elected at age 58, and he died at, I think he was 84 when he died. So, but particularly towards the beginning, I mean, you would go on 2-week trips. I mean, something that would last 11 days, going through, you know, all of Brazil and part of Argentina, or something like that. Yeah, I mean, the only advice I might give him is maybe it's selfish from my point of view. Just because I give you an example because this is kind of selfish on my part. But when we went to Colombia, the last day of the trip, we flew out, I believe, of the capital, Bogota, I believe, and just went to Cartagena. And just spent one day there without sleeping there, and then left for Rome. And I would say, oh, why don't we just spend 3 days in Cartagena? It's so beautiful. but that's me being selfish.
I see. Well, thank you very much, Philip.
Okay.